It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Federal Reserve is expected to announce an interest rate cut this week, the first since 2008 and the dawn of the Great Recession. We'll find out what the move could mean for the economy and for you. First, once upon a time, food and cooking shows were few and far between on TV, and they were mostly how-to instructional programs. While you can still tune in and learn some useful recipes, the world of food TV has expanded a lot over the last decade or so to help feed the growing appetites of curious viewers. And that growth is showing no signs of stopping, with major streaming services like Netflix and Hulu announcing more and more cuisine content to come with each year. Michael O'Connell is a writer for The Hollywood Reporter. He wrote a piece on peak food TV. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, for people who aren't keeping track, can you give us a sense of the scope? How many shows are out there now and still in production?
At the moment, there's a little over 70 food-related shows across platforms, and that's if you ignore the like 5-minute shows that air on YouTube and some of these smaller streaming platforms, of which there are many. But like proper like half-hour to hour-long shows, there's over 70, and in the next year, there's going to be over 100.
What is it about these food shows that has caught on among TV networks and viewers?
Well, you know what? There are several reasons. I mean, one, like, we cannot underestimate the power of the more is more attitude and approach that the television industry is taking right now, with all these new streaming platforms emerging, it getting so much more competitive, and the linear, like old school networks, there's just more and more offerings for customers. But it's also proven to be this wildly exportable genre. You can air a food show in America that follows a Mexican family in the outskirts of Los Angeles and their culinary traditions. You add subtitles, you can put it anywhere, and people in any country are just as eager to watch the way other countries are cooking. And that isn't the same for a lot of unscripted television, and it isn't the same for a lot of scripted television either.
That's interesting. I've heard that argument for action movies. Action translates really well all over the globe. You just need to throw some subtitles on. TV food shows are a similar genre, apparently.
Yes, unlike rom-coms, which do not translate as well.
So take us back to some of the proto food shows. Who are some of the people who first gave us the idea that, hey, it's fun to watch people cook on the TV?
Well, I mean, Julia Child really was the first major American personality to break through on television. And she started out in I think it was only distributed on Boston Public Television. It ended up being a national program, but she rose to immense celebrity because of her cooking on television. And there were other instances over the years. The Frugal Gourmet comes to mind in the 80s. But it wasn't until the Food Network really hit its stride after about a decade on the air that we started minting dozens of well-known either TV chefs or home cooks who had great personality and could translate to television. But the sort of like dawn of the celebrity chef, I would say, is in the mid-aughts. Because, I mean, up until the 90s, working in food wasn't even a profitable business. Like, no one wanted their children to be chefs.
Another appeal that you wrote about, actually, for a network wanting to produce these things is they don't, unlike food, they don't expire. If I watch a cooking show from 2 years ago, it might be just as relevant to me as one that came out yesterday.
Oh, completely. I mean, tastes change over the years, and there are certain things that aren't as repeatable. But for the most part, especially if you look at these travel logs, where people go to different countries and interview home cooks or farmers or cheesemongers, these things are evergreen and they replay really well. And another sort of argument for them in streamers getting on board with them is the streaming culture on like Netflix and Hulu and these upcoming platforms. It's very different than how cable is operated. On cable, there are a lot of channels where people just sort of like set it and forget it, and it's on. It's background noise. Like, that's how Food Network and HGTV became these multi-billion-dollar brands. But streaming is still like more of a proactive view. You have to go in and you have to select something and you're always being presented with choices. And these food shows, you can just put them on and they run and they run and they run. And you like, they just keep viewers engaged.
Talking to Michael O'Connell from The Hollywood Reporter. We're talking about peak food TV, 70-ish shows out there now. We're going to hit three digits pretty soon. He says you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch cooking shows or shows about restaurants and food? Why? What are your favorites? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael, we heard from David on Facebook who says, I really liked Anthony Bourdain's show. I miss him. David's not alone, and the loss of Anthony Bourdain really left a void in the food world, didn't it?
It certainly did. And I mean, he's been gone over a year and his legacy is well reflected in the recent Emmy nominations. The last few episodes of his show that CNN aired pretty much swept the nonfiction categories in nominations. And it's funny because people recognize that there is that void right now, but people are so sensitive about his legacy that copycats aren't going to emerge for a while. I think people are being very respectful about that. He had a very, very, very unique voice, and a lot of people credit him with this sort of elevation of style of food TV.
Looking at some other big names in food TV, Gordon Ramsay, this guy is all over the place, whether he is actually on the camera, it sounds like, or whether he's behind the scenes producing shows. Can you talk about the Gordon Ramsay industry?
I mean, the Gordon Ramsay industry is huge. Not even including television, he's trying to open 100 restaurants in the United States over the next 5 years. He just got this massive round of funding from a private equity firm. But I mean, he's been a staple on the Fox network since, I believe, 2005, 2006. He occupies over 10% of a primetime schedule on a broadcast network, which is just truly remarkable. And these shows wax and wane. They're not as huge as they used to be, but he's still a force to be reckoned with on that network. And as many people do when they have a taste of success, he's getting into producing and is now going to start making food shows that aren't necessarily vehicles for him because he is quite stretched thin.
And there's a huge variety of shows out there. You write about the prestige ones. I think Anthony Bourdain's travel shows fit that. And a big one that kind of seems like it came out of nowhere to me, this Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat TV show / book / phenomenon. Can you talk about where that fits in?
Samin Nosrat, who sort of came up at Alice Waters' famous Berkeley restaurant, whose name that I can't remember at the moment, she was sort of just like a chef's chef. People have really respected her for a long time. She had a New York Times Magazine column. She just went on hiatus with it to work on some other stuff, but she's been doing that for years. And she's just been very well liked in that community. And then the book was huge. It won a James Beard Award. It's already in its seventh printing, I think. And she got a Netflix show out of it. And she was just such an eager, refreshing personality for a television show because she just had no awareness whatsoever of the cameras. And that's really rare.
And then we had this explosion of, I guess, game show type cooking shows, the Chopped, Cutthroat Kitchen. They're competitions. The participants aren't usually celebrities. The judges kind of are. That seems to have a lot of appeal, and it's easy to watch one after another of those.
It is very easy to watch. And that's been the most successful, I mean, when you talk about success in Netflix, it's all anecdotal because we don't really know how their shows rank. But Nailed It has been a big success for them. And that's the show where amateur bakers try to duplicate sort of Instagram-friendly, elaborate desserts to comical results. And that's been a wild hit for them.
Talking to Michael O'Connell, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, about the popularity of cooking shows and the explosion of cooking shows out on the market. More to come. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of food TV shows, whether they're about cooking or restaurants or travel and food? What are your favorite programs? What got you hooked in the first place? Are you ever inspired to cook something based on one of those shows? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Michael O'Connell, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, talking about the rise of food television and what's coming next from the industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch a cooking TV show? Do you watch lots of cooking TV shows? What's the appeal? Which one really says something to you? Have you learned stuff, or is it just fun to watch other people do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Rebecca?
Well, I love cooking shows. I watch a lot of them. I've seen Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat at least 3 times, because there's so much in there. But when you were introducing the segment and that you and your guests were talking about former cooking show stars, I was reminded of and wondered if your guest remembers The Galloping Gourmet from a million years ago when I was a little kid. Whenever it came on, my father loved it. He would grab a pad of paper and pen and write down the recipe.
Wow.
And because, well, there's no internet or, you know, anything like that, and would make elaborate things from Graham Kerr was the cook or the chef, and my father even did this one recipe that he wrote down and followed to the T, making seafood crepes from scratch with the fish base and everything.
Wow.
And we ate dinner at like 11 o'clock at night.
Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing that. My producer tells me Galloping Gourmet was about 1969 to 71. So Michael, I mean, that's a case where, and that makes me think, so people would have to learn and watch and write down the recipe. Food shows can, they can just post the recipe online. They don't need to be as precise, even if they're trying to teach you how to cook.
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, like the internet has changed so much of this, but when you think about it, a lot of these cooking shows are basically vehicles for cookbook authors to sell books. That's how Ina Garten got into Food Network. That's how Nigella Lawson got into food programming. They come out with these shorter series every time they have a book to publish, and it totally works. I think that Ina Garten's most recent book was the top-selling cookbook of that year, and she did like a little like 10 episodes for the Food Network for it.
Rebecca, thanks for reminding us of The Galloping Gourmet. We'll go now to Emily with us in West Bend. Emily, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about? Do you watch any cooking shows, Emily?
Oh, well, that's one of my favorite things to watch. And I am one of the many people I know that is addicted to The Great British Baking Show. I absolutely love it. Everything from their wonderful personalities to the different ways that they approach the challenges. And I have learned so much just by watching that show. I was so daunted with anything that was yeasted before. I have now made my own pizza dough.
Fantastic.
Oh,
Emily,
good.
One of the things I hear people like about the Great British Baking Show is, you know, a lot of reality shows, cooking or otherwise, people are really mean to each other. It's much nicer on the British Baking Show, right?
It really is. They're all like good neighbors.
Emily, thank you so much. Michael, I think especially with public radio and public TV fans, the Great British Baking Show is a big hit.
Oh, my gosh. That show is huge. It's huge over there. It's huge over here. And I think a lot of that is due to just the civility between those contestants, which is just not what we're used to seeing on our American reality television.
Emily, thanks so much. I want to share an interesting story from Leslie, who wrote on Facebook. She says, I'm a cancer survivor. For over 12 months, I was unable to eat food and had a feeding tube. And she says, almost everyone who has some type of inability to eat food due to health reasons watches food shows. All the shows, all day and night. It's very common. Seems crazy, but it's true. Leslie says they inspire and give people hope for their future. It's not just the food, the taste, the shopping. It's hope. And Leslie says, whenever I need a happy place or some fun, I know a great food show will never disappoint. I would have never thought of that, Michael, but what an interesting story.
I couldn't watch food television when I'm hungry. So that is quite remarkable. It's the opposite of what you'd expect.
Me too. Leslie, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. Let's go back to our callers now. Tron is with us in Milwaukee. Tron, hi.
Hey, this is Tron. Oh, I love watching the cooking shows. Hello?
Yep, go ahead, Tron. You're on the air.
Oh, there you are. Oh, I love watching the cooking shows. But I like all the ingredients and everything else, and some of these are a little bit exotic, you know. But, you know, the thing about it is that when the cooking shows are going, they have all these fancy equipment that some of us don't have. But that's where, if you are like, when you can actually, I got it right in my face.
Okay, I think we're losing you there, Tron. But Tron was saying they have a lot of fancy equipment, and it's maybe hard for the viewer at home to replicate what they're doing in what's clearly a well-set-up commercial kitchen, Michael.
I think that a lot of shows are evolving past that, and because they recognize the barrier to entry can be quite significant in kitchens. Not everyone has a Vitamix or a stand mixer. And I think that there are, especially when you go online to like the websites associated with these TV chefs or with the programs, they give you workarounds if they are indeed using something elaborate. But I mean, you don't see a lot of like sous vide-ing happening on these shows.
Tron, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Michael O'Connell from The Hollywood Reporter, looking at the rise of cooking shows. Michael, before we go back to callers, you mentioned a bunch of shows coming out, still in production. What are the trends you're watching for in the future when it comes to food TV?
As far as trends, I think it's a lot of moving away from the very standard, we're in a kitchen and we're preparing a meal. There used to be a lot more live studio audience stuff too, and I don't think that we're going to see much of that. It's a lot of road shows and sort of getting stories behind food from the people who cook them, cultural stories, and then showing a way to do that in your own home.
Let's go back to our callers now. Patrice is with us in Horicon. Patrice, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am calling to express my admiration for Nancy Fuller, Farmhouse Rules, and for simple reasons. As Sean was talking about, she doesn't use a lot of inaccessible or unreplicable equipment or recipes. And I think the main thing is that she really just is engaging. She expresses herself. She isn't self-indulgent like some of the other hosts are. And I just think that she really has a complete relevance to almost anyone who's just interested in good food.
Patrice, thank you so much for the call. Farmhouse Rules, she recommends. That reminds me, Michael, there was a reality show where people were trying to become the next food show TV star. Do we know what makes a good food TV show host?
I mean, it totally depends, and no offense to many of the graduates of that show, but not many of them went many places except Guy Fieri, who was the second winner of that show, and he did quite okay. He just got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Guy Fieri, yeah, there's a kind of a controversial figure. It seems like people have a love-hate thing going with Guy Fieri. What do you think?
I think that we're approaching the renaissance of Guy Fieri. I think that he was the butt of a joke for a long time, and people are starting to recognize that he's just like, he's a fun, passionate guy. And I think that there's more goodwill for Guy Fieri right now than there was maybe 5 years ago.
Let's go back to our calls. John is with us near Prairie du Chien. John, hi.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Sure. What shows have you watched, John?
Oh, my all-time favorite has to be the original Japanese Iron Chef. That show was just fabulous. I learned more from that show than I did from the year in cooking school that I went to in 1972-73.
Wow. Okay. Wow. John, thanks a lot. Yeah, so Iron Chef was a big phenomenon, and it was ahead of the curve for a lot of these shows, it seems to me, Michael.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And then there was a U.S. adaptation that I don't think it's entirely dead. I think it comes back and forth on Food Network. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, it's been quite a consistent performer over the years.
And that's kind of another genre. It's a contest, but not for everyday schmoes. This is taking, and it Beat Bobby Flay, I think, is in this category. It's taking people who are really good at this and putting him through the ringer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you look at a show like that, I feel like it's definitely an inspiration for Top Chef, which has become the sort of prestige cooking competition in the United States.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go to KC in Monroe now. KC, hi.
Hey, real quick, when I was a kid, I used to watch a show called Yan Can Cook, and I don't think anyone else ever even mentioned the show, like, ever again.
But wrong. I watched Walk With Yan with Stephen Yan on CBC. I could see it from Michigan. Where were you watching Stephen Yan, KC?
Oh, on the PBS back when I was a kid, close to 20-some-odd years ago. But this guy would, like, literally cut up everything and look at the camera while he's cutting it up and not even pay attention at all. Like, I want to see some more showmanship like that.
Casey, thanks. Yeah, and I remember Stephen Yan just, like, you know, he'd measure out spices by just grabbing a handful of it and throwing it in, and he's right. Never looked away from the camera. Yeah, who do you like as a showman, Michael, in the shows these days?
Oh, my gosh, who is a showman? I mean, Gordon Ramsay is, like, a showman with his attitude. you don't see a lot of the chopping with dramatic flair anymore. I feel like people are shifting towards more of a utilitarian approach to cooking, and there's no, I mean, whatever, Emeril Lagasse is probably the one from the most recent memory with Bam, which inspired a NBC sitcom briefly that didn't last.
Thank you, Michael, so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Michael O'Connell, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. He joins us today to talk about how food TV has captivated audiences, grown big time, a lot of shows on the market, still in the pipes. Still time for you to share your favorites or least favorites. If so, why do you watch them anyway? You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, an interest rate cut from the Federal Reserve could be announced as soon as this week. It'd be the first since 2008. We'll find out what that can mean for the economy and for you. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time, BAM, on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's Shark Week. We look at shark management and conservation in the U.S. and around the world. First, the Federal Reserve is expected to make what could be a big policy change this week. For the first time since 2008, interest rates could see a cut. The last time the Fed cut interest rates, the nation was in the midst of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Since then, interest rates have remained low by historic standards, but have seen gradual increases in recent years. Heather Long joins us now to talk about what the move could mean for the economy and for your money. She's an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, this is unusual, right? Usually you cut interest rates when the economy is in bad shape, when it's tanking. We've had 9 years of pretty steady growth. How unusual would this be?
It's highly unusual. You just said it really well. Things look pretty good in the economy. Hiring is very, very strong. We've got this unemployment rate lowest in 50 years. On Friday, we just saw the latest peak at how the economy is growing, and it grew this spring at 2.1%, which by all measures is pretty darn healthy. You and I and all of our friends, American consumers, we keep spending. So that's propping up the economy. Same thing. We have a stock market at record highs. So the reason that they're doing this, they're calling it an insurance cut or a preventative measure. So kind of like getting your immunization shot. They're trying to act sooner rather than later because they see a lot of headwinds overseas. And they are concerned that, you know, as Europe and Japan and China get sick, that's going to eventually cause the United States to catch cold, too.
One of the arguments against this, though, is that you want to save this kind of action for when things are bad. If you've already got interest rates at rock solid lows and then a recession comes along, that's one less tool you have in your toolkit.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There just isn't a lot of ammunition that the Fed has. It's hard to remember back to those pre-crisis and Great Recession days, but you know, heading into that really terrible time, you know, interest rates were sitting at about 5%. Today, they're sitting at 2.5%, so half that. So that they just can't cut those interest rates as much as they have in past recession times to try to boost the economy. So you're right. There's a fear that are they acting too soon? Are they using all their firepower now? Another concern is a lot. We don't think about this a lot, but we don't want to end up like Japan. You know, Japan's basically had zero or negative interest rates for years and a pretty lousy economy because of it. And there's kind of this catch-22 of, you know, you want to lower those rates because you want to help keep the economy growing at a pretty good clip, but do you get to a situation where you're really hurting yourself a lot more in the out years?
For an everyday consumer who's thinking, okay, I want to borrow money to buy something, a house, a car, a college education, or just, you know, charge stuff on my credit card, does an interest cut like this from the Fed affect that consumer?
Normally the answer is yes, but this time around, as we wrote in the Washington Post, it's probably not going to make a huge difference on Main Street. It sure has sent the stocks to record highs in the last several weeks. But the reality is, like you say, for mortgage rates, for auto loans, for credit card loans, you know, 25% basis point is not huge. And, you know, borrowing's pretty easy right now. I was looking at some homes myself over the weekend, and you know, mortgage rates are already at a three-year low. So people who are maybe sitting on the sidelines like me, debating, hey, should I get back in? Should I buy a home now or not? There just aren't a lot of people like me who are sitting around having that debate right now. Most people have already bought because rates have been low for so many years.
Is this an incentive to spend and not save? Because at the same time, as you say, credit is fairly easy to get. Saving money, you're not making a lot of money with these low interest rates on whatever, savings accounts, CDs, even some bonds and investments.
You're right. It is. That's kind of part of what they're doing. They are making it cheaper to borrow money and basically spend instead of save. But I think for a lot of middle class folks, what usually happens, or we've seen in the last several years, is it kind of pushes people to maybe take a little bit more risk, because if you want to earn more than that piddles we're earning in our savings accounts, you have to put your money in the stock market, and that's definitely a lot riskier. Or instead of buying government bonds, people have been buying, you know, these high yield bonds from risky companies to try to get more of a yield, to try to get more of a return. So I think that's more the bigger concern on the Fed's radar screen right now, is both, are we pushing, you know, average Americans as well as companies into riskier and riskier assets? And does that eventually cause a bubble that could be really nasty?
Heather Long is with us, economics correspondent for The Washington Post, talking about an expected interest rate cut, expected this week, in fact, from the Federal Reserve. I want to pick up on that last point you made, Heather, because you're talking about a situation where there's easy credit incentive to take risky investments. That sure sounds like, say, 2005, the years leading up to the Great Recession. I guess 1920s, years leading up to the Great Depression, too. I don't want to over-exaggerate here, but how big a worry is that?
Well, it's a legitimate worry. I would say that's why my inbox probably has 60% of the people that I talk to who support the Fed doing this cut this week, and 40% are saying, heck no, all this is going to do is spur more risky borrowing and put us in a bad situation like we've been in the past, or think of the dot-com boom. So what's different this time around is all of us remember that the housing debt buildup of the early 2000s that led us to that precipice in 2008. But this time it's corporate borrowing, which, you know, we don't always read as many headlines about. But basically, companies are the ones who have gorged on debt in the last several years. We have record levels of business debt around the world. And there's kind of that, you know, proverbial, are we going to have a moment where a bunch of companies took on all this money and they can't afford it. They can't pay back their debt. So the lower interest rate probably should make it easier for those companies to pay back debts. But there's a little bit of a danger. Are you also just incentivizing not so great companies to go out and borrow, load up on the debt even more?
Do we have a sense of how much, I guess, debt to asset companies have these days? People look back at the lead up to the Great Recession, and for every dollar, say, one of the big banks had in assets, they were taking $25 or $30 or $40 of risk on, riskier risk than they thought it turned out. Do we know what's going on now in the corporate world, or is this the sort of thing you only figure out in hindsight?
Yeah, everyone's trying to get a handle on it. I will say it's a much smaller segment of the market. Some of these, they always give them great names, like collateralized loan obligations, CLOs. This is kind of the similar situation going on with the corporate debt side. The good news for you and me and all your listeners is most of that corporate loan or CLO, most of these riskier corporate loans are owned in by like hedge funds or Japanese banks or a big holder. So it's just not, it's unlikely to bring the entire financial system down in the way that mortgage debt did, because mortgage debt was just held by so many different banks and investment funds. So that's the good news. The bad news is, yeah, we probably, there's probably a risk that we don't fully understand.
Now, the Federal Reserve, it's supposed to be, in theory, independent of political pressure. President Trump has been putting some pressure on the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, say wanting this kind of interest rate cut, not liking the increases that happened over the last year and a half. Is there an argument that, hey, maybe this political pressure is swaying the decision made by the Federal Reserve?
Well, the Fed leaders say it's not, but I like to put it this way. They're human. And so probably it has about a 5 to 10% impact on them. You know, it's a factor, but it's not the main factor. I'd say probably a bigger impact, you could argue, is actually Wall Street investors. You know, Wall Street is pricing in 3 rate cuts. So not just one this week, but another one in September and another one in December. Basically, they want a rate cut party. And so, you know, that's not a good sign. It's going to be very tumultuous if the Fed comes out and doesn't deliver. You know, it's like you don't give the screaming kid what they want, and you're going to have a lot more screaming. And so I'd say that's a little bit more concerning to people who follow this stuff closely, is the Fed getting bullied a bit by the market. So we'll see. Fed Chair Jerome Powell does not have an enviable job right now.
Speaking of, you know, you mentioned that there were pros and cons arguments coming in your inbox. You also wrote that even among Federal Reserve key figures, this is not unanimous. There are some people within the Fed system who are saying, hold on, this is not the time to do this.
That's exactly right. We're expecting at least one dissent, possibly two, the head of the Boston Fed. So everybody always thinks of Powell. You know, Donald Trump's always, the president's always saying nasty things about the Fed chair, the top Fed leader. But it's actually a committee of people who make this decision. And so several members of that committee have already come out and indicated they're not so happy about this rate cut. So, but hey, that's actually healthy. You know, we're in a really confusing and uncertain time for the economy, and you want robust discussion. You want debate. You don't want a whole group of people who are all thinking the same way. It's just like you want diversity at your company or in your organization or in your news team.
As we wrap up, Heather, what does success look like? This thing comes through maybe Wednesday. How do people who evaluate this stuff decide, yeah, this turned out, this is a good idea?
Well, there's the immediate reaction, and that's you just look at what the stock market does that day. So if they really blow it, kind of like in December when they didn't get their message across very well, you'll see a big sell-off, couple hundred points down in the Dow. I think they've learned a lot of lessons, but it's a tricky tightrope because they're going to be cutting, and at the same time, they're trying to say, but we're going forward. You know, this isn't like a free lunch. We're not just going to keep cutting unless we think the economy really needs it. They don't want to scare people by saying, oh, we think the economy is so bad, we got to cut like 2008 again. So it's a bit of a tightrope. And I'd say watch the market. And then second of all, I think you got to watch what's going on in the coming weeks with, with auto loans, with home loans, that sort of thing. Does there seem to be anybody spurred to, you know, to pick up their activity a little bit.
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Take care.
That's Heather Long, economics correspondent at The Washington Post. She joins to talk about why the Federal Reserve might be announcing an interest rate cut this week and what it means for the national and household economies. Coming up, as the Discovery Channel and its viewers get ready to mark the annual Shark Week, our guest says we should respect the shark instead of fearing it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the energy firm Enbridge is facing two lawsuits over its Line 5 oil route, including one from a northern Wisconsin tribe. We'll get an update on those cases and hear what concerns people have about the pipeline. First, it's that time of year, Shark Week, but shark management and conservation doesn't stop once the programming ends, and sharks do face a lot of threats. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, demand and exploitation rates for some shark species and products are increasing. Meanwhile, many of these species are especially vulnerable to overfishing. Taylor Chappell is a research scientist at Stanford University working to increase our understanding and appreciation of sharks on a local and global scale. Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Taylor, before we get into conservation and threats to sharks, can you just share some of your appreciation? You've devoted your life to the study of sharks. What is it about them that you find so fascinating?
Well, I don't know how much time we have, but I'll try to get into a little bit of it. So sharks are, you know, this quintessential predator. They are an incredible force in healthy ecosystems. And so I really get excited about understanding the complexities of these animals and how we can use those complexities, the really cool parts of sharks, in order to engage people and get the public excited about them as well.
And among other things you've done, you've worked with, I think, tagging great white sharks for research. You've been slapped in the face by a great white shark's tail, I believe. What's it like to be that close to this incredible creature?
It's sort of funny because when I tell people what I do for a living, I study sharks. Their first thing is they say, wow, that's cool. And then the next comment out of most people is, isn't that scary? And for me, it's crazy because it's not. It's exciting. I always tell them the scariest part, the most dangerous part of my day is getting down to the boat, not getting on it or being around the sharks. In those moments when you're sort of, you know, eye to eye with the shark, it really is magical. It's one of these like moments that you can't really describe because you are experiencing one of these incredible predators, one of our most amazing predators, I would say, in my mind, in their natural habitat. And really, you get to experience what they're seeing. And so, you know, being close to them, being in the water or on the water around them, really is an experience that's more exciting and rewarding than it is scary, for sure.
There are hundreds of shark species, as I understand it, and many of them are threatened or endangered. What are some of the biggest threats facing sharks today, Taylor?
Unfortunately, the biggest threat facing sharks is us. On average, there's upwards of about 100 million sharks a year that are harvested by humans, and that's usually for fin trade or for some type of products. And so, you know, on a global scale, maybe a handful, 5 to 10 people globally are killed by sharks, whereas we're killing hundreds of millions of them a year. So they definitely have much more reason to be afraid of us than us afraid of them.
You mentioned shark fins. Canada recently became the first country in the G7 to ban shark fin imports. Can you talk about the impact of the trade in shark fins, the consumption of them, and efforts to change that?
Yeah, shark fin is the real driver behind most of the fisheries that target sharks. And so we're talking about, you know, the fins per pound dried can go for $50 a pound, $100 a pound for those fins, whereas the meat itself goes for almost just pennies. And so the real driver of these markets to capture and to harvest sharks is the shark fin market. And most of those go for shark fin soup into the Asian markets. And so, you know, countries like Canada that are working to, you know, to stop the import of these fins can potentially have incredible effects on the market. And, you know, in the U.S., we don't have a national ban on shark fins, but there are certain states, including California and Hawaii and a few others, that have bans so that these shark fins can't be imported, they can't be transported, they can't be held at all inside those states. So, you know, we are making steps, at least on the state level. And, you know, every little bit can help.
Talking to Taylor Chapel from Stanford University about sharks, shark conservation, shark management, and inspiring respect and maybe a sense of awe for the sharks of the world. Taylor, you mentioned sharks, of course, predators. What happens to an ecosystem if they lose a predator like a shark?
So sharks' role in a healthy marine ecosystem is similar to what a lion is on the Serengeti. And they basically establish these top-down controls. And so a healthy ecosystem has a balance. You have just the right number of predators. You have just the right number of prey. And as you tip that balance, then all of those levels below get off kilter. So imagine, we'll simplify it and say sharks eat seals, seals eat salmon, salmon eat anchovies. So if your shark population gets killed off, then your sea lions, your seals are going to, that population is going to increase greatly, and they're going to eat all the salmon. And so there's no salmon left for us to harvest. Since there's no salmon, there's going to be tons of anchovies because there's no salmon to eat those anchovies. So all of a sudden you have this ecosystem that's full of sea lions and anchovies and none of the sharks and salmon. So it really throws everything out of whack if you lose those predators.
Now, the movie Jaws, I think, shaped a lot of people's thinking about sharks. And I seem to remember the author of the book the movie was based on, Peter Benchley, regretted that. He ended up donating money to shark conservation. He really regretted the role that Jaws played in shaping a fear of sharks. Do you see society as a whole making a similar switch to getting more respect for sharks now?
I would like to say yes. I think that there is a lot more information out so that the public and all of us can learn more and understand more. And part of my role as a scientist is to learn about these sharks and then share that, like right now, about how cool these animals are and why we need to be appreciating, why we need them in the ecosystem. And one of the first seminars I went to as an undergrad was to see Peter Benchley. It was the summer of the shark down in Florida, and there was a few attacks, and he came to talk about it. And for me, it was really, really interesting to see someone who I really felt was at the foot of the issues for fear and apprehension of sharks, trying to make a difference. And I knew that he had regretted what Jaws came out to be and was trying to change that. And I said, well, let's try to get on the forefront of this and see if we can continue to change people's mindsets, because fear is not what we should be feeling when we see a shark or we think about a shark. Appreciation and just wonder is what we should, in my mind.
We talked about the idea of banning the import of shark fins for soup, as Canada has done, and as you mentioned, some communities in the U.S. have done. Are there other conservation priorities out there that could help, especially those endangered or threatened species?
There's a number of different ways that we can, besides banning shark fin, that we can help to protect sharks, and one of them is habitat destruction. So coastal areas like mangrove forest and estuaries, so where fresh water comes in from rivers and salt water mixes with it, these are nursery habitats. They're critically important for small sharks. So sharks come in and they give live birth to babies. We call them pups. And so they give live birth to pups, and those pups will remain in these estuaries or these mangrove forests for the first few years in order to be safe from predators, as well as to find plenty of food. And when we have these coastal destructions, remove mangrove forests, build breakwalls and things like that, we can destroy those habitats. And so that's a real key place that we can think about in terms of our direct effects on conservation.
In our last few moments, I've heard arguments for restoring mangrove swamps in part for storm surge protection as well as habitat. Do you see a move? Are more communities, maybe more countries, trying to work to say, okay, let's not demolish these mangrove areas?
I think as we see more significant weather events happening, that conversation comes up. You know, we've talked more about barrier islands down along the Gulf Coast. And I know on some of the islands that used to have mangrove forests, that they are reconsidering that. Historically, those have been degraded for some type of industrialization, whether it's things like shrimp farming or it's building high-rise buildings and things. I think that folks are starting to understand, but until we can really put conservation on the same playing field with money making, with building buildings and things like that, it's a really hard sell.
Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Taylor Chappell, research scientist at Stanford University. It's a shark week on the TV, and he joined us for a look at sharks, the threats they face, and why he hopes humans can see them with more respect and take on more conservation efforts to keep sharks in the water and turn around the threatened and endangered species. Should pineapple ever be put on a pizza? The so-called Hawaiian pizza with pineapple and ham can generate a lot of strong responses. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Me, I'm in the middle. But how about the head of the nation's cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency? He says Hawaiian pizza is a valuable lesson in foreign election interference. What? Christopher Krebs with Homeland Security's main cybersecurity division sent out a tweet attacking pineapple pizza while at a security conference. He says there's a lesson behind it. He says online hot takes like that tweet about pizza or others on more serious divisive issues are often used by foreign intelligence agencies seeking to interfere in the U.S. The goal? To exploit divisions among Americans, to create doubt, and to get attention for troll accounts created by those agencies that they then use, especially as election times get closer, to send false and misleading information. If you click through to the Homeland Security website under the War on Pizza hashtag, you'll find lessons on how to react to controversial stuff on social media. One lesson, quote, if it seems like an account is only aiming to raise tensions, think about whether it's worth engaging. So the take home, don't spread all the angry stuff online and eat your pizza with whatever you want on it. No judgment. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.